joint employer rule. This was a final rule as of January 13th of this year. This is a big one in that this is an issue that's been a flashpoint of litigation over the decades, whether a particular employer is to be considered a joint employer of the employees in question. That, together with the question, the somewhat related question of whether an individual is an employee versus an independent contractor, these are issues that have been litigated throughout the FLSA's history, and always sparked some controversy. And the Department of Labor has shifted back and forth with changing administrations over the way that they will interpret an employer's or a given company's status as an employer. In 2016, for example, under the Obama administration, the Wage Hour Division issued an administrator's interpretation, giving a fairly expansive interpretation of who is a joint employer. And this rule tries to bring it back the other direction. What the rule does, and the rule throughout the pretty lengthy rule, it refers to what it's doing as guidance. It is published through the formal rulemaking process, but it is characterized itself as guidance. And it says that the test, as courts have used different iterations of an economic reality test to determine whether a particular company is an employer under the FLSA, sometimes focusing more on one particular factor or another, and recognizing that we get to look at the totality of the circumstances. No single factor is dispositive, which this rule does recognize. But this rule seeks to focus on a narrow version or iteration of the economic reality test. This is derived from or based on the 1980s Ninth Circuit case, Bonnet versus California Health and Welfare Agency, which has been followed, at least in some circumstances, by many circuits, including the Fifth Circuit and Gray versus Powers, where they focus on four factors: whether the putative employer hires or fires the employee, the employees, can supervise or control employees' work schedules, determine the employees' rate and method of payment, maintain employee records. The new rule says that you should really focus on that test, and it's really a little bit narrower version than that test as it's explained in Gray versus Powers and Bonnet. And the new rule also asserts that whether the employee is economically dependent on the potential joint employer is not relevant. So that's really only a question that's relevant to the issue of whether an individual is an employee versus an independent contractor. And that's in contrast with the guidance from the 2016 administrator's interpretation. It also lists a number of factors that it says are not relevant, shouldn't be considered, or at least shouldn't be considered to find joint employer status. And it also gives a number of illustrations, examples of situations that it says shouldn't demonstrate joint employer status. And if you check out the paper that John and I provided, one of the things that I've pointed out with regard to several of these new rules is that I think it's going to be interesting to see whether the courts are going to afford Chevron deference and going to follow the Department of Labor's rules here. And you might remember the Encino Motor Cars versus Navarro Supreme Court case from 2016, where the Supreme Court said that Chevron deference shouldn't be afforded to the Department of Labor's regulation interpreting a particular overtime exemption for certain sales employees, where the department had previously taken the opposite position and employers and employees in the industry had relied on the previous rule for many years. and the Department of Labor didn't offer, in the court's opinion, a very sound explanation for its reversal. And that's something that I think is a question mark for several of the new rules.